KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Before.
I know of no way that I could buy grain off of a farmer and legally plant it.
And this shows you how polarized the debate is right now and how things just get absolutely blown out of proportion.
This good customer of mine saw me and said, "Oh, the chef in the hat. Marketing, marketing, marketing." Trademarked the name, and I've been the chef in the hat ever since.
Terry Rotaro, the chef in the hat, will be here a little later to look inside your refrigerator and see if he can make a meal out of the dregs of your shopping. So take a look. Take some pictures. Post it on Facebook, weekday on KUOW. And then when 9:39 rolls around, we are going to have him here, and you will call in or have some pictures posted or emails sent, and we'll see if he can make a meal out of capers, mayonnaise, and an old pork shoulder. That's coming up on weekday. Also, Michelle Rhee is going to talk to us about education reform. But we begin with the plight of Farmer Bowman. The Supreme Court will be hearing arguments this week in the case of Bowman versus Monsanto. The case pits the Indiana soybean farmer, Hugh Bowman, against the multinational agricultural biotech company Monsanto. Monsanto has a patent on genetically modified soybeans that are resistant to the weed killer Roundup. Farmers who buy the seed are not allowed to replant them after the initial crop. The decision is expected late spring or early summer from the court, and it has implications far beyond the fields in Indiana. John Entine is executive director of the Genetic Literacy Project. He's columnist in Forbes, Science 2.0, and Ethical Corporation. John, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Glad to be on the show.
What exactly did Hugh Bowman do?
It's actually a fascinating case. Hugh Bowman is a 75-year-old Indiana soybean farmer. And like most soybean farmers who have had a choice of whether to use genetically modified or non-genetically modified seeds, he chose, like 90% of soybean farmers, to use the GM kind. Why? Because their yields tend to be a little bit better. They are forced to use a Monsanto-patented type of herbicide called Roundup. Glyphosate is its actual technical name. But that is well-known and been well-tested to be far more benign toxicologically and on the plants themselves than what conventional farmers use. So most farmers have switched over to it, but there's a twist to it. It comes with a license, a patent protection, and it means you have to use it just once, and each year you have to buy your seeds new. That's what the patent requirement has. And what he decided to do was, instead of buying it new, he had a second planting he had each year, a fall planting, which some soybean farmers do. It's usually a higher risk, lower yield opportunity. So instead of buying new Monsanto seeds, he bought what are called commodity seeds. They're seeds that are usually given and fed to animals. But they're, because so many of the farmers use Monsanto seeds, it actually had the Monsanto seeds in it. And he got the Monsanto plants and used the used the Roundup Ready spray. And so essentially broke the patent. And that's the central issue here. Can he do that to cut costs? Is there a legal loophole here, or did he break patent law?
Now, when he bought these second-generation seeds, he bought them from grain elevators. Were they all mixed with other seeds, or were they separated out?
No, they all mixed with other seeds, but the reality of it is, since 90% of the soybean farmers use it, I mean, the mix was probably similar to what it is in the real world, 90-10. So he knew very well, and all the farmers knew, that the commodity seeds are would have the Roundup Ready in it. There's just a patent restriction Monsanto has maintained, and they've been upheld in two federal courts. And in this case, this is not a lot of wiggle room, and the case has already had a day and a half of oral arguments. The justices are not sympathetic to Bowman's position at all, because he knew exactly what he was doing. He was definitely trying to circumvent the law and basically saying, "I don't believe the law." It's essentially a social protest. Should a large corporation have a right to control patents on genetically modified organisms? Basically, he's taking the activist position, no, and this is really emblematic of a fight about GMOs. The particulars of this case, which will actually determine how the how the justices will vote, and Bowman will lose on those counts, is really speaks to a larger issue about the place of GMOs and patenting in our society.
Just on that note, John Entine, how did the case make its way to the Supreme Court? Where did Bowman get the backing to appeal and bring it up through the courts?
Yeah, he has pro bono lawyers who support him. A lot of public interest groups, or they call themselves public interest groups, groups like the Center for Food Safety, their agenda is specifically to get GMOs banned. They saw this as an opportunity to ride on this issue. I mean, they portray themselves as defending the family farmer. You know, 90% of the family farmers use GMOs, so they're defending a certain view of the family farm, that's for sure, but they're really not defending the family farmer per se. So, you know, he has a lot of support. I think Monsanto, which, you know, there are a lot of serious issues about patent protections, and I don't want to suggest that Monsanto should get a free ride, or any company that is involved in GMO should get a free ride on this. And the human genetics issue is coming up in another SCOTUS case in a few months, and I have a different opinion on that one. You know, it's a serious issue. It's being debated. And there's a lot of people who support it. And essentially, this is an activist suit that Monsanto never thought would get to the Supreme Court. My guess is that the court took it on not because they thought that Bowman had a chance to win, but because this fight keeps going on in the lower courts. And this is a way to essentially make this type of patent law fairly clear. And this issue won't come up again. Because based on the arguments yesterday and what's going on this morning, I've been monitoring them. I don't think Bowman has a snowball's chance in hell to win this case.
John Entine is a reporter and a writer. He's at the geneticliteracyproject.org, Forbes magazine program. As you said in the brief, and as we know, Roundup Ready seeds account for 90% of the U.S. soybean crop. Have you heard, or would the court object to what is a near monopoly on a critical food crop?
Well, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer, so frankly, that sounds like an interesting legal idea. Monopolies, though, are in this case, it naturally evolved. So they're not forcing anybody. You know, I think it would be a monopoly if they only were no one else could introduce, let's say, their own version of a genetically modified soybean seed, and anyone could. Obviously, conventional stuff is out there. Whether the fact that a monopoly has evolved could conceivably pose a problem, you know, my guess is that's probably an interesting line of litigation. Maybe Bowman should have gone down that route, but that's really not my area of expertise. That there's probably lots of ins and outs of the patent laws that would suggest that's a great way to go, or maybe it's pretty thin ice too.
Yeah. All right. Well, how about this is interesting too, though. The universities around the country, research universities and biotech firms in particular, are backing Monsanto in this. What's their larger concern? What's their larger interest?
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody who's a reasonable person would be concerned about, you know, how patents can be used to create monopolies. I mean, that was implicit in your question, and I share that. And frankly, like I said, if we want to talk about the myriad genetics breast cancer mutation testing issue, which is also before the court, I flip to the other side of the issue on that one. You know, I mean, there's no question that this is a complicated issue, and there's a great concern. The broader issue is that genetic research is not cheap, and the barriers one has to go through to get approval for genetically modified vaccines, products, new biomedical devices is extremely high, littered with litigious public interest groups trying to stop it because they have a fear of certain kinds of high technology developments. And so there's a real fear, universities which depend on money that they get from patents, that they will not be able to gain back all the money that they pour into basic research, which is a larger part of what universities do, if the ruling by the court is written in such a way that it broadly affects things. Now, the court, my guess is, will write this so narrowly that it won't have those implications that everybody fears could happen, but you never know. I mean, the SCOTUS judges, the Supremes, could really throw the gauntlet down on patent protections on this and rewrite patent law. That is not beyond the realm of possibility here.
Well, it is definitely telling us that the lines continue to be drawn. We'll see how they play out. If this doesn't go good for the interest groups, they're going to find other ways to challenge GMO in different places.
And they should. I mean, you know, I'm a strong believer that GMOs is a sustainable technology. On the other hand, you know, this is America. We should have vigorous debates on these things, and public interest groups play an important role in keeping industry's feet to the fire here. But they're not going to win on this one. There's no possibility, I don't think, at this point.
The Supreme Court is hearing arguments this week in the case of Bowman versus Monsanto about the replanting of Roundup Ready genetically modified soybean crops. John Entine is executive director of the Genetic Literacy Project. He also is a he also works at George Mason University in the Center for Health and Risk Communication and the Statistical Assessment Service. I hope we talk again about that other case. I appreciate you taking the time.
Great, thanks. I'm glad to be on the show.
Thank you. This is Weekday.
It's 9:15. Some thoughts on saving our education system in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from City University of Seattle, a private, not-for-profit university where students can earn a master's or bachelor's degree in teaching, business, counseling, or information technology. More information at cityu.edu.
38 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says clouds all day, chance of rain later, and a high of 46. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:16. What random collection of leftovers is hanging around in your fridge? Well, whatever you have, chances are the Chef in the Hat can help you turn those leftovers into something delicious. So take a look in your fridge and be ready to put Chef Terry Rotaro to the test in 25 minutes.
Michelle Rhee was chancellor of the Washington, D.C. public schools from 2007 to 2010. She had what some people call the tough love approach to her work, firing teachers and principals once on national TV during a Frontline documentary filming. She closed 23 schools in 1 year. She left after Mayor Adrian Fenty, who hired her, lost his reelection bid in part over her tenure as chancellor of D.C. schools. In 2010, she founded Students First, a nonprofit organization working on education reform issues, ending teacher tenure, paying teachers a higher wage based on skill and merit. She began her career teaching for 3 years in an inner-city school as part of Teach for America, and she founded and ran the New Teacher Project, which in 10 years recruited and trained more than 23,000 new teachers to work in urban schools. She's written Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's actually start with the most important issue.
Okay.
Kevin Johnson, your husband.
My husband.
Mayor of Sacramento.
Yes.
Is he going to keep the team or are they coming to Seattle?
I'm afraid we're going to keep the Kings in Sacramento.
You think you got the money? The money's there.
My husband is rounding up the money as we speak, and I can tell you from firsthand experience that my husband always gets what he wants.
All right. We're gonna test you on that later. All right. What do you make of your tenure at DC?
I think what we were successful at doing was changing a culture that had over time really atrophied to the point where, you know, we were in a position where only 8% of the eighth graders in the city schools were on grade level in mathematics, and folks seemed to think that that was totally acceptable. And so what we did was really decided to turn things around, put the focus on putting laws and policies in place that would benefit children, even if it was politically difficult to do, and held people at every level of the school district accountable for ensuring that we were educating our children well.
What's the peer-reviewed science that tells us that rating a teacher will get us a better educational system?
Well, there is a recent study put out by the by Harvard University that looked at something called the value-added model of teachers. And what it showed is that when you have a highly effective teacher, meaning a teacher who rates very highly on the value-added scale, that one teacher in the course of a kid's lifetime can increase their likelihood of graduating from high school, going on to college. It increases their long-term career earnings, and it also decreases the likelihood that child will get pregnant as a teenager. So we know now that that teachers matter, absolutely, and that if we can put a highly qualified and highly effective teacher in front of every kid every single day, that it could have a dramatic impact, especially on low income and minority kids.
How should teachers be first evaluated? What are you looking at? What are the criteria?
The first thing that we look at is whether or not they raise student achievement levels. And you have to do this carefully because in order to be fair to teachers, you can't just say, okay, well, how many of your kids, say, are at grade level at the end of the year? Because teachers might inherit classes of children who are coming in at wildly different levels. So what you have to do in order to be fair and transparent is look at where the children come into the classroom and look at where they are in terms of their skills and academic progress at the end of the year and see how much growth there was. The other thing that you have to do is you have to control for factors that are outside of the purview of teachers, things like, you know, socioeconomic status, special ed status, ELL. Those are things that teachers don't have any control over, so you have to make sure that those don't factor into the equation.
Can you take those out of the equation of evaluating teachers?
You can run a regression analysis, yeah, that actually controls for those factors. A couple of other things that are important in evaluating teachers, and actually the Gates Foundation, who is here in Seattle, has done a lot of research on this, shows that the other components that you want to have in teacher evaluation, one is observations of classroom practice to see firsthand how those teachers are doing interacting with their kids. And then the second thing that the Gates Foundation has found that I think is very interesting is that they found a very high correlation between how students rate their teachers and how effective those teachers are in terms of raising student achievement levels.
Is that also been peer-reviewed? Are those studies that the education system across the board agrees with finding?
The bottom line is, in education, as in many sectors, there are no studies that everybody universally agrees with. But what I do think you will find in this country is that everybody universally agrees that the current evaluation systems are not working.
And why don't they work? Michelle Rhee, author of Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. Why don't they work? What are they lacking?
They lack rigor, to be frank. If you talk to any teacher out there today, they will tell you that they get precious little information from their yearly evaluation, that sometimes they see their principal making, you know, in their classroom. Sometimes they don't. They might get, observed once a year, maybe in some states once every 5 years. I mean, it really varies. And what we want teacher evaluation to look like is that we want it to be, first and foremost, a professional development tool for the teacher so that they understand very clearly what they're excelling at and what they need to improve. But also it needs to be able to show us as public school district administrators, parents, the public of, you know, where are we in ensuring that every single child has a highly effective teacher in front of them every single day?
You did a report card for Students First on states around the country. And Louisiana was ranked. What grade did you give Louisiana? Nobody got an A, did they?
No, they got a B.
Yeah. Washington State got a D.
Yes.
There are people who look at Louisiana's outcomes and say, well, they may be changing their efforts, but they're not changing the outcome of the students. Why did they get a B?
Well, our report card is based on the policies that a state has in place. So there are lots of other report cards out there that look at student achievement levels and where each state is. Our policy report card assumed that, say, the achievement levels are what they are for each state. What is the potential in that state for children to the academic achievement levels of children to really accelerate based on the policies that they have in place? And Louisiana last year just implemented a series of really aggressive policies that we think are going to, I mean, they haven't been fully implemented yet, but when they are, we believe that they're going to show massive improvements for kids.
Name some that you think are very, very effective.
Well, you know, a couple policies that we think are most effective. We talked about one, which is teacher evaluation. Another one that's very important is making sure that when layoffs occur, that we can take into account the quality of a teacher instead of just the seniority. In places like Washington State and many other states across the country, you have systems where you implement something called LIFO, which is last in, first out, which means if you are the last person hired, you must be the first person fired regardless of performance.
But Washington State's changing that. They have laws in place to change that over time.
there are still so many things that need to be done. And there are some things, for example, Washington State just put in place a new teacher evaluation system. It doesn't get put in place until 2015, you know, right. A variety of things. So while those things should be applauded, it needs to move a lot quicker if we're going to make sure that our kids are in high-quality schools.
You think the teachers should be paid more?
I think that that effective teachers should absolutely be.
Well, you think ineffective teachers should be not in the system, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So you think teachers overall, you should think teachers should be paying, I think, what did I see, $145,000 for one number?
Well, in D.C., we were able to, when I was the chancellor there, we were able to basically double the pay of the most highly effective teachers who are teaching in low-income schools in high-need subject areas. And I think that's important because I think that we send a message to members in our society about how we value education by how well we pay our teachers. And if they are not paid well, if this is not a profession that's looked upon highly, then that says something about us as a country.
That money can be paid to teachers without adding more money in the system, or does the system need more money?
Actually, there are ways to do it without adding more money to the system now. You know, in an ideal world, school systems would have more money, sure, to put into lots of different programs. But, you know, we have worked with a number of cities and states across the country who are saying, okay, here is our budget. That is not going to increase. But is there something that we can do to put more money into paying the most highly effective teachers?
Well, didn't you get rid of a lot of people at the central administration?
Absolutely. Well, I cut the central office bureaucracy in half. We started off having about 1,000 employees. By the time I left, it was 400 and something. And I would say that almost everybody in the city said that it was operating much more efficiently.
Why was it so bloated?
You know, I can't answer that question of how it got bloated, but I can tell you that, you know, as I was walking around the school district office and asking people, well, you know, what do you do for kids every day? They say, well, you know, that lady over there, Dr. Johnson is my boss. I do whatever she tells me to do. And I said, that's not a job description. Every single person in this central office should be providing a critical service of one kind or another to kids. If not, then the money needs to move down from the central office to the schools where it's going to have much more impact.
Are teachers' unions the problem?
Teachers' unions are not the problem in the way that many people want to pretend they are. You know, lots of folks say, well, if we just didn't have unions, then, you know, everything would be hunky-dory. And the bottom line is that teachers' unions are doing exactly what they are supposed to be doing. Their job is to protect the rights, the privileges, and the pay of their members. And they are doing a bang-up job of that.
You don't think they have the interest of the children and that they're educating in mind?
That's not the purpose of the teachers' union. The purpose of the teachers' union is to protect and benefit their members. And sometimes, you know, as a superintendent, I can tell you that sometimes the union and the district could agree on things that we both thought were going to benefit kids. Sometimes the union wanted things that had a neutral effect on kids, which I was also fine with. Where I drew the line was when the unions wanted to put in place a policy that clearly had negative ramifications for children, like that last in, first out policy that I talked about. The research on that policy shows that it has three negative consequences. One, you end up firing more teachers because the junior teachers are paid the least amount of money. So to fill the budget gap, you have to fire more teachers, which means disrupt more classrooms. The second is that it disproportionately negatively impacts poor and minority schools. So it's clearly not a good policy for kids. And when you ask union officials, other people, well, if it's not good for kids, why do you have it in place? They largely say, you know, in an honest way, that it's to benefit their members so that they can have, quote unquote, fairness amongst their members.
You know, we have a high stakes test controversy here in Seattle right now. You know about the measure of academic progress. Mm-hmm. And there are teachers who don't want to be giving that. They say it's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that test?
I don't know it particularly well. I've read a little bit about it, as I think lots of educators across the country have. And here's what I think is the bottom line. We have to do a lot of work in this country to improve the standardized tests that we have. They are not as good and not as rigorous as we would like them to be. That said, I think everyone would tell you that we have to have we have to have tests that measure in a standardized way how kids are doing so we can do apples to apples comparisons. And so the question in my mind is, how do we get to a point where we can be working in the same direction on making better assessments?
How? Well, that's the question. How do we do that?
Well, there's a lot of evidence out there that shows what works. The study that I talked about before, which shows that teacher quality has a huge impact on student achievement. You have other studies in various parts of the country that show things like in New York City, they are having huge successes with the charter school movement there. And it is very clear that the charter school movement is not only positively impacting the children who attend the charter schools, but it's also having a positive impact on the neighborhood schools because there is competition for the kids, because there are options for parents when they're unhappy with failing schools. And that has, in many ways, lifted all boats.
Michelle Rhee is author of Radical Fighting to Put Students First. She was chancellor of the Washington, D.C. School District, has gone on to work in nonprofit. Let's talk about your political, your work, your nonprofit work. You talk about this a little bit. So you are, as you said, a Democrat, or a Democrat, I assume you still are.
Always will be.
But you work with Republicans who look like they're interested in some governors, interested in decreasing the power of teachers' unions in order to save money or to reduce their power. And you also talk about the Democratic Party as a whole, where the mm-hmm. teachers' unions have an inordinate amount of delegates, I think it was 10% at the conventions, mm-hmm. and a lot of money. Are they standing in the way of progress?
There are Republicans who support the Students First agenda, like Chris Christie and Brian Sandoval, the governor of Nevada. And then we have strong Democrats like Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, and Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles. I mean, these people are some of the strongest, most stalwart members of the Democratic Party, and yet they know that this is what we need to do for kids.
What is that?
Elevating the teaching profession and making sure that every single child is in the classroom of a highly effective teacher every single day. I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that that's what we should aspire to as a community. The second thing that
the difficulty in getting there that is the problem.
But just the fact that it may be difficult to get there, I mean, that's a reality. But that shouldn't stop us from trying, from aspiring to make that a reality. Because for anybody who wants to argue, well, as people did all the time to me in D.C., well, if you have an ineffective teacher in the classroom, then your job as the district is to invest in that person and, you know, 2 or 3 years and see if they can get better. And from a system perspective, that may make sense. But from a parent perspective, I don't want my kid in the classroom of an ineffective teacher to see if they can get better over the course of a year. There is not a parent out there who would say that they want their child in the classroom of an ineffective teacher. So if we're not willing,
I believe you
to
had
do
an
that,
example of that with somebody who was criticizing you, a politician. Right?
Yeah, it was actually, you know, it was because of the layoffs that we did. We did our layoffs by quality instead of seniority, and this politician came and said to me, "I'm going to demand that you reinstate all 266 of these teachers that you laid off because you didn't lay them off by seniority." And I said, "I'll tell you what. These 266 people that we laid off by quality were some of the most ineffective teachers in the district, many of them. I said, you have 4 children, none of whom are in the D.C. public schools. So I'll cut you a deal. If you bring one of your kids back into my system, then I will and allow me to randomly choose one of these laid off ineffective teachers and have that be your kid's teacher, then I'll bring one of those teachers back." He didn't take me up on it.
All right,
why?
Let me...
Because he was not willing to subject his own children to something that he was absolutely willing to set public policy on.
All right, let me take the last 5 minutes on criticism, which you get a lot. What about that? You have kids in a private school in Nashville.
You know, I am a public school parent.
I know you say that, but you have kids in private school, right?
I am a public school parent. And
does that mean you don't have kids in private school?
That means I am a public school parent.
I don't know what that means.
It means I am a public school parent.
Well, so am I.
So,
but I have kids in public school. I don't want to know.
I have kids in public school, too. And so that's what it means to be a public school parent. It means that your child goes to public school. And you face the reality every single day. And that's what actually drove my actions in D.C. was that my kids were in the D.C. public schools. And every policy that I put in place was not just a policy. It was going to impact my two kids. And so I made decisions for everyone's child in the same way that I would make for my own two kids.
Right. So your kids are not in a Nashville public-private school.
I am a public school parent. And I think it's best that we keep any problems that we have with each other as adults, right, in the education reform movement to adult issues instead of dragging children into it.
I don't quite get that answer, but okay. Let me ask you a different question. Some of the effective schools that were tested in D.C., since later there seems to be, and the Department of Education is investigating, a cheating scandal. And their main problem was the most effective school, a school you cited, a principal you respected, mm-hmm. many more erasures in those test results.
Absolutely.
And what's your response to that? Not in terms of whether you pushed that or not, because nobody's accusing you of that, but was the pressure placed in the wrong area?
Well, first of all, let me be clear that there were five different investigations, three by outside companies, one by the D.C. Office of the Inspector General, and one by the federal government, the U.S. Department of Education. All five of them showed that there was no widespread cheating in the District of Columbia's public schools. So let me be clear on that. There were, in a couple of those studies, they showed issues at one particular school. Now, would we say that it was because we had put a pressure on? I don't understand what that means, because quite frankly, in every school district across the country, shouldn't we put a lot of focus on raising student achievement levels? I mean, that's what we're there for, to make sure that kids are learning.
But we want to make sure it's accurate.
Absolutely. And that's why when there are questions about test integrity, you have to take them seriously. You have to have those investigations. You have to have really tight test security measures.
Okay, I got to ask you about why you taped kids' mouths. And then later, you took the tape for punishment, you took their tape off.
No, that was not true.
All right, well, tell us what happened. Yeah. Give me that
so
real quick.
So this was actually a story that, and this shows you how polarized the debate is right now and how things just get absolutely blown out of proportion. So I was talking to a group of first-year teachers, and I told them, I said, I was telling them the story about when I was a first-year teacher, and I said, my kids tended to be really noisy in the hallways. And so one day, I was saying, put your finger on your mouth like this, on your lips, like as a piece of tape, and we're going to walk all the way down to the cafeteria like that. Everybody put your finger on your mouth. And one of the kids said, well, I want a piece of tape to put on, to make, you know, to put my clothes. So I took a little piece of scotch tape and, you know, I put it on his mouth. And so we're walking down.
One kid.
No, well, it was a couple kids may have asked for it. So not all of them, certainly. And it was, you know, it was sort of I was saying, let's do this. And then one of the kids, when he took the tape off, he did not lick his lips before he put it on. And so he pulled off a piece of dry skin. And what this has turned into on the internet and in blogs is she duct taped the mouths of her children. I mean, it's really crazy.
Why is that happening?
It's because the debate in public education reform has gotten incredibly divisive and very, very polarized. And so it's turned into this, you know, there are villains who. And here's the thing, you know, I believe very strongly that the teachers' unions, they're not people who are villains who are trying to do wrong by kids, who are trying to do anything evil or something like that. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is protecting their members. You know, if you disagree with my policies, then that's fine. Let's have a debate about the policies. But by calling into question somebody's, you know, they're talking about, you know, things that have absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about for kids, which is how can we put in place good evaluation systems? How can we put in place options for families so that every kid has a shot to go to an excellent school? The polarized, like off-the-chart debates do nothing to move us forward.
Where's this debate going to be in 5 years?
Where I think we have to head is in a place where we stop having these debates on these polarized extremes where no one actually is. And we need to get into the meat of things. Let me give you an example. We at Students First advocate that of a teacher's evaluation, 50% of it be based on how much students grow academically. One of the National Teachers Unions, AFT, has approved and sort of put their stamp of approval on an evaluation system in Connecticut where 35% of the teacher's evaluation is based on student growth. So if that's where we are, the difference between 35 and 50, then let's have a real conversation about that 15%. Don't start all this stuff about they want to evaluate you solely on the basis of test score, because it's not true. Nobody in this country, not a single person that I know, policymaker, politician, academic, I have not seen one shred of paper that has ever said, let's evaluate teachers solely on the basis of test scores. But why are we out there scaring the bejesus out of teachers on that? It just doesn't make any sense.
Michelle Rhee's book is radical, Fighting to Put Students First. Thank you.
Thank you.
School reform is a contentious issue, as we all know. Tomorrow, we're going to talk to Dora Taylor, who writes at the Seattle Education blog and amassed a lot of critiques about Michelle Rhee and has some thoughts about how Seattle education might be reformed and what's happening here and what's happening around the country. We'll talk to her tomorrow on Weekday.
In the more immediate future, we're going to be joined here in a minute by Terry Rotaro, the chef in the hat. Terry's going to help you turn your leftovers into a gourmet meal, or at least a tasty snack. Stick around, that's mere moments away.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's Theater's production of The Edge of Peace. A mystery surrounds a community when a beloved World War II soldier is reported missing in action, February 28th through March 17th. Tickets and info at sct.org.
39 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Chance of rain later this afternoon with a high today of 46. Then we're expecting clouds and rain overnight with a low of 39. And tomorrow, Thursday, looks like rain at times with a high of 46.
Support for KUOW comes from the Moore Center for Eating Disorders, committed to providing compassionate and comprehensive care for adolescents and adults with eating disorders through their partial hospitalization and outpatient programs for over 20 years. More information at moorecenterclinic.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:41. The government is saying that if there's no agreement before this sequester kicks in on March 1st, hundreds of thousands of civilians who work for the Department of Defense will be furloughed, meaning forced to take unpaid leave for one day a week starting in April. That's a 20% cut in work and a 20% cut in pay. More on that in 20 minutes. But first, put on your dancing shoes and start moving toward the fridge.
All right. This song goes out to all the leftovers.
One of the reasons we like to have people come back is so we can play excellent theme songs. What's in the fridge? That indicates Terry Rotaro, the chef in the hat, is in the house. You like this song, right, Bernard?
I do like it. Shall we play it all the way to the end?
No.
2 minutes and 10 seconds more.
No, we'll play it on the way out.
Okay.
Because you know how that can go sometimes. Good to see you, sir.
Likewise. Good morning.
Rovers is still open at this point?
Our Rovers is still open. It's doing fabulous. Actually, everybody's coming to visit.
Because you're closing it.
We're closing it at the end of May.
Luke
25 and a half years later.
Luke is still open?
Oh, Luke is booming.
25 and a half years.
Have you done anything for 25 and a half years?
This show.
Exactly.
This job, I should say.
Isn't it incredible? 25 years is a long time.
Yeah, you look in the mirror and you go, what happened to my youth?
Well, youth is all... You know, it's all comparable to whatever you want it to be. I still feel very young. You know, I feel very, very young. So, am I not on?
No.
How's that?
We decided to put you actually on the mic.
As opposed to catching the sound of the
video.
Yeah,
just my mic. Just you coming in on my mic. I don't know why that was happening. I apologize to our listeners. But there you are.
So, anyway, yeah, it's been an incredible road, and it's very cool to see everybody coming in and, you know, reminiscing of all the great time they've had at Rovers over the years. That's you know, I see teary eye once a day. There's at least one person or two that just start teary-eyed. Like, you don't understand. We spend all our anniversary and birthdays and special occasion here. What are we going to do next?
Now, remind me, I'm not going to take up too much time asking you to reminisce, because people have to go to the refrigerators and then come back to us with a stumping question for Terry Rotero, since we want to know what's in the fridge, which is why he's here. So our number is 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. Survey your refrigerator. Take a picture of it if you'd like. Put it on Facebook, Weekday on KUOW. Email us, weekday@kuow.org. Or just call 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. And let's see what we learn about chefing from what ingredients you have. People come in, they reminisce, and they say, boy, I remember this meal or that meal. Anybody surprise you? Any memory that was jogged? Said, oh, I didn't remember I'd cooked that.
Well, there's people who say, you know, we got married in your restaurant, and I'm looking at them, and I'm going, oh, yeah, that's right. I actually forgot, because I've seen them so many times over the year. You know, they say, we proposed here. Do you remember what you did for us? And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. My memory does not work that well. I can't remember everything I did for the last 25 years.
No, I understand. All right, we'll come back.
It is pretty cool to see how much you affect somebody's life in 25 years. It's pretty impressive.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to the question before we're done. But here, Nancy sent this on Facebook.
All right, Nancy.
Bubby's Pickles.
I love it. That's a great breakfast to start.
tamarind chutney.
Okay.
Tofu. Almond milk. Cucumber. Oh, well, she made it easy for you. And lamb stew meat. I thought she was going to just stop. Let's pretend there's no lamb stew meat. Make a meal out of that. But all right, lamb stew meat.
Lamb stew meat is cool.
That's it.
All right, so we're going to make...
That's easy. I could even do that.
Okay, what would you do?
I would. I think I'd marinate the lamb stew meat in some tamarind chutney.
Okay, good. Well, no.
No?
You would, no,
too
you
strong?
Would, yeah, well, chutney is not something you can marinate.
Well, you dilute
it. Like a garnish on the side.
Well, you can dilute it. A good tamarind flavor. All right, what are you going to do? You're the chef. What do I know?
I thought this was my
chef. Yeah, what the heck? Hey, it's not called Steve in the Hat.
Well, I would definitely do a nice chutney. I would add to the chutney, because I would do a pickle and cucumber. I would take the cucumber and peel them and dice them, or not peel them if they're really good, fresh, tender cucumber. And I would dice them, and I would put them with the pickles, because I would basically cut down the pickling flavor. So now you have almost like a sweet and sour. It's not sweet. It's just soft.
So put it in a bowl. Put everything together in a bowl.
So when you eat that, you kind of have the high and low of pickling versus not.
Nice.
And for the almond milk, I think I would probably try to make a little flan with probably that tamarind tamarind chutney that she has. So I would put the two together, probably crack. I crack a couple eggs.
There's no eggs here.
Well, I'm sure she has eggs in the fridge. Well, yeah, of course there is no eggs here. Who doesn't have any eggs in their fridge? Tell me. Maybe some people don't.
It's late at night, and there's no shopping possible.
I would make like a little flan of crack some eggs, put a little bit of the almond milk mixed with it, and then put the chutney in it and put that in the oven and bake it at 300 degrees. So it doesn't boil, so it's just in a double boiler in water.
So a chutney flan.
Yeah, like a chutney flan kind of idea, be kind of Frenchy meets India. And for the lamb stew, obviously, you could do many things. The first thing I would do is marinate it, probably with some spices, since we're going kind of Indian style here. I would do some spices, mostly curry and salt and a little bit of honey. I would do the whole thing together and mix it together and let it sit for a couple of hours. While you're mixing it, you know, every 30 minutes or so the meat is really well cured and marinated. And then I would just sear it, give it a nice sear, and then put it in a pot, and then put a little bit of, I would probably put a little bit of white wine, and then put that in the oven just like that, and cook it very slowly, kind of braised. And then when the meat is cooked, now on the side you have your chutney, you kind of have your little pickle cucumber salad. And if you didn't want to mix the pickle and the cucumber together, you could still make a cucumber salad, and I'm sure then you have yogurt in the fridge or something.
Are you doing anything with the tofu?
Well, the tofu, you could add it anywhere, and it would be delicious. But, yeah, you could definitely make a salad with a cucumber and tofu, for example. Or you could – I like to take tofu, and I like to bread it and not deep fry it, but fry it. in a pan and do a nice little crunch. So now you have crunchy fried texture. You have cucumber salad, let's say julienne cucumber or sliced cucumber salad. And then you have your pickles also on the side. So you get all these different components that can go with your fried tofu. And then on the side, you have your lamb stew and tamarind.
I like that pickle and cucumber mixed together, too. That sounds
yeah,
nice.
It's kind of nice because it kind of tunes the two and makes the you know, and if especially if you take a little bit of rice vinegar and mix that together with it, makes a nice little, even a little bit of olive oil added to that, be a nice little flavor, nice little salad.
Well, I think it's pretty good.
Cracked pepper everywhere, and there we go.
Well, that was easy. Let's see what Bruce has to say in Ballard. Let's see if Bruce can make stump the chef here, the chef in the hat, Terry Rotero. Hello,
hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank
you. I
don't
think I'll stump anybody. But so last night, my wife made some mac and cheese. It didn't quite turn out the way she had hoped.
What happened?
The recipe, she generally does great. Generally, I do most of the cooking. But she was cooking last night. This mac and cheese recipe, I think, would be okay, except it called for all these breadcrumbs to be on top. When she baked it, they never really browned. And I said, and the whole dish turned out really dry. So I said, I'm going to attempt a mac and cheese rescue. And my thought was, last night I took all the mac and cheese, dumped it in a big mixing bowl, and mixed it around a lot so that the breadcrumbs that never really baked would dust the pasta.
Right.
Thinking that this would preserve it until today, and then I would create some sort of cream sauce, you know, put all this mac and cheese in a baking dish, pour the cream sauce back in there, and rebake it.
Yeah, and I would definitely sprinkle a lot of cheese on top, so you're kind of like a gratin idea. So the only thing that's going to happen, make sure you put enough cream, because that breadcrumb is going to – basically what happened yesterday is the breadcrumb, maybe too much of it, sucked up all the moisture that was around in the dish.
Yeah.
And that's what can make it so dry.
Yeah, and so my question is, how should I go about making this cream sauce that I'm going to attempt to do this?
You know, I would just reduce some cream by half. So if you take a cup of cream, you reduce it by half to a half a cup. So now what happens is your cream is a little bit more condensed. It's a little bit more denser. And you put that all over your macaroni. You mix it really nicely. And I would grate a little bit of Comté or Gruyère or, you know, some kind of a cheese like this that would be delicious. I don't know. What kind of cheese did you put last night?
I think it had fontina, mozzarella, and some Parmesan. And there's some pancetta in there and some...
Wow.
And parsley.
And with the mozzarella and everything, that was still dry, huh?
Yeah, I was surprised. And it was quite a bit of cheese. So I don't know. I thought I happened to have some whole milk in my fridge. I thought I'd melt a little more Parmesan in it in a pan and then pour it in there, but I didn't.
Yeah, but if you just put milk, it might get a little bit too runny. You need to reduce something down so it's a little bit thicker.
So cream.
Because you're not trying to cook the whole dish. You're just trying to make it, bring it back to life. So...
Exactly.
So you don't want to be baking it for like an hour and a half, because that's going to be drier than it was yesterday.
Right.
So you want to try to reduce down that. If you have any cream, you don't have any cream, you only have milk?
Yeah, I'm trying to.
So I would make a quick roux, you know, just a little bit of butter and a little bit of flour in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
And then once that's cooked in the pan, I would just pour in the milk on top of that and make what's called a bechamel.
Yep, got it.
But a light one. Don't try to make a very thick one.
Right, right.
You want to make it so then the milk is binded, basically. So,
okay.
What temperature should the oven be at?
It should be at as high as possible, I think.
Because he wants to cook it fast.
You just want to gratinate the whole thing. You want to give it a little crust. You want to give it a little texture. You're not trying to cook it because it's already been cooked. So you want to go as high as possible. If you can make it 400, 450, that would be fabulous because it's only going to take... It shouldn't take more than 15 minutes to gratinate your whole casserole there.
All right, sounds good. Bring it over when you're done, Bruce. all right, Courtney's in Seattle. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Courtney.
Hi there.
What do you got?
I have temperately beans grown in Arizona sitting on my stove soaking in water.
What is it?
Pinto beans.
Oh, pinto bean.
No. Temperly. T-E-M-P-E-R-L-E-Y. Temperly beans.
Okay.
Oh, I don't know those beans.
They're from Pane Bianco in Arizona. And I have some mini meatballs in the freezer that I've made. And I have harissa and baby spinach.
Ooh, you have harissa. I love harissa. It's my favorite spice right now.
It's my husband's, too. He had it on a BLT last night.
Ooh, my kind of guy.
Uh-huh. I've never cooked pimperly beans, so I'm a little stumped.
Well, I must say that I've never cooked pimperly bean either, but I'm sure that it's not that complicated much. I mean, it's a regular bean, right? What does it look like?
It's a tiny white bean, almost like a small Italian white bean.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would
like
be fine.
Like the size of a black bean.
So I would say probably soak it for, you know, in you could use a little bit warm water, not hot water, just a little bit of warm water. Soak it for a couple of hours on the counter.
That's what I'm doing now.
And then drain that and then put some fresh water in there, cold. And put a little bit of flavoring in there. Like, you know when you take a half an onion and you put a few cloves on there? Like mm-hmm. two or three cloves on there. You do that. Put a couple of garlic cloves in your beans. And then that's about it. A little bit of salt. I like to put salt in my beans, but easy.
You put salt in your beans before you cook them?
Yes, I know. Most people say it's not true. You're not supposed to do that. But, you know, my mom was the one who taught me how to cook beans. And I like my beans to be falling apart when they're cooked. Mm-hmm. I hate crunchy beans.
And the salt helps that?
No, the salt doesn't help keeping it together.
What's the pro or con for salt?
People are saying that if you put salt in your beans, all the skin comes out, all the beans fall apart and this and that. And I'm like, that's the way I like my beans, so it's okay. I don't mind that. But to go back, and then with your meatball, I would definitely take the meatballs and take some diced onion, really fine diced onion or shallots if you have any.
Mm-hmm.
Put that into your meatballs and put a little bit of harissa in your meatballs.
Oh, okay.
And then you make some nice little... So you could take the meatballs, once they're thawed out, you could just press them down, make a little mini patty,
mm-hmm.
you know, and put that on your in your bean stew once the beans are cooked. So you'll have, you know, ground beef and beans.
What's harissa again?
Harissa is a hot pepper from North Africa that is made into a stew. And it's basically hot pepper stew. That's what it is.
All right.
It's lovely is what it is.
Yes, it's lovely. You're right.
Courtney, thanks a lot. Appreciate that. All right. Here's this goes fast. Here's from the Facebook page. My daughter has high cholesterol. Doctor said she has to eat lots of salmon. But nobody in our family except me likes salmon. So do you have suggestions for how to serve salmon without anybody noticing that it's salmon? Which is, frankly, sacrilege. But go
yes. ahead. So my first recommendation is buy the best, freshest salmon you can buy. Because that already will be a much better fish. It won't be strong. It won't be, you know, it won't be tasting or smelling like anything. It will definitely have this beautiful, fresh fish flavor, which is what you want to look when you buy fish, because that's why most people are scared of fish, because they walk into a supermarket and they smell that thing and they look at it and it looks like there's a urine sample next to your fish and you're like, I'm sorry, that's not what I want to eat tonight. I want to eat something good, you know. And a good fish has no smell, no water, nothing, none of this stuff going around. It's a beautiful piece of fish, glossy and everything. So I would say then one of my best recommendations would be to make a rub that would be a little bit spicy. Because usually when there is heat, it covers up a little bit of things. So I would say just make a salt and spice rub that you put right on top of your salmon with a little bit of olive oil so it sticks right next to the salmon. And let it sit on the counter for about an hour and then cook it. So it will have impregnated the salmon. And then I would do a nice amount of side garnishes, such as you could do beans, you could do vegetables, you could do all kind of different things. Sauteed mustard green right now, fabulous on the market. Just a quick pan sauteed of mustard green. Then you put on the side. So the diversion and the flavors are combining, but yet they're not, the salmon is not the main, you know, if you just put a piece of salmon in the middle of a plate and that's all you have, you will be eating salmon. But if you put other things to, you know, make the salmon a bit smaller and the vegetable a bit bigger.
Which is how we should be eating anyways, right? All right, here's real quick. Give me this. I'm just curious. Can you make one dish out of this? Arugula, pears, parsnips, phyllo dough.
Oh, yeah. You could make a wonderful salad. So what you can do is take the phyllo dough and bake the sheets, brush them with a little bit of butter, and bake them by himself. And then on the side, you make an arugula. You said arugula, apple, and...
Your pears and parsnips.
Pears and parsnips. So you take the parsnip, you peel it, and then you julienne it, and you do a quick pickling of water. You know, I'm always pickling things when you're
pickled.
Well, because sweet and sour pickle is, you know, what you do is you do 2 cups of water, 1 cup of salt. I'm sorry. 2 cups of water, 1 cup of vinegar, 3 cup of water, 1 cup of vinegar, and a cup of sugar. You mix the whole thing together and you bring it to a boil and you put some spice in there. Then you pour that over your parsnip julienne for like 20 seconds. Then you take them out of there. So now they've been partially blanched but flavored with that pickle flavor. And then you mix that with your arugula and your apple. And your apple will be the sweet part of the pears. And mix that with that. And then the phyllo, when it comes out of the oven beautifully baked, brown, you take it and you crumble it. So now you have a crunchy arugula, apple.
Pear.
Yeah, you use a phyllo to do that. And then the phyllo, you sprinkle a little bit of salt on top of it.
That is why you are the chef in the hat. And even without a hat, you're the chef. Terry Rodero is at Rover's for a little bit longer. Restaurant Luke as well. He's author of Rover's Recipes from Seattle Chef in the Hat. He's on that other radio show on Saturdays.
Saturdays and Sunday on Cairo with Tom Douglas and Seattle Kitchen.
Seattle Kitchen.
And don't forget to podcast that show because over 100,000 a month now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. You can hear him there too. And you should come back.
All right. I'll be back. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
It's 9:59. A mixed report on housing out today. That and more of the day's news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, committed to improving lives through education. With short-term certificates, transfer programs, and career training in nanotechnology, business, and more. Online.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.